With AMC Plus, the plus doesn't just mean more, it means better. Available through the platforms you're already on, AMC Plus is a premium streaming bundle with the best of AMC, plus the complete collections of Shudder, Sundance Now, and IFC Films Unlimited. Get the latest from The Walking Dead with early access and exclusives. Binge acclaimed series like Mad Men ad-free, and with new content dropping each week, like Gangs of London, a powerful drama about London's criminal underworld, there's always something fresh to check out. Sign up at amcplus.com. AMCPLUS.com. AMC Plus. Only the good stuff.
In France, there's an old saying that every madman thinks he's Napoleon. And for a while in the 1800s, that was true. Mental patients who thought they were Napoleon became so ubiquitous that it became a bad asylum cliché. In one old myth, it was said that one asylum actually put all the men who thought they were Napoleon in the same room, where they could bicker about who was the real emperor. Now, even though this probably never happened, it underscores how deeply Bonaparte affected the popular imaginations of Europeans. He was absolutely larger than life. When he grabbed hold of power in 1799, Napoleon began a process of transforming himself from being a formidable general to becoming a living legend. You see, Napoleon was a student of history, and he liked to imagine himself as being akin to the great figures of antiquity. He wanted to be something like Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar. And indeed, before he was done with France, he would create an imperial system that would make him more like a Roman emperor than any Ancien Régime king of France. But how much of Napoleon's impressive reputation was simply myth or propaganda? How many episodes of bravery or brashness were exaggerated or just plain invented? And finally, what are we supposed to believe about Napoleon's strange death? Could a conspiracy still be hiding the truth about the assassination of one of history's biggest personalities? All that and more on today's Our Fake History. Episode 7, Napoleon Bonaparte, Man or Myth, Part 2. Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name's Sebastian Major, and this is the show where we look at historical myths and try and figure out what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. For those of you out there wondering about this seductive, gravelly tone to my voice, yes, I've been recovering from a cold, but the show must go on, so away we go. This is part two of our two-part look at Napoleon Bonaparte. So if you missed part one, you might want to go back and download the first installment to get yourself caught up. If you've already heard the first part, or you don't really care about these kinds of things, then let's do this. Last show, we looked at Napoleon's early career and his rise to power in France. We also took on some of the most well-known myths about Napoleon, namely that he was a short French guy who blew the nose off the Sphinx. We all learned that he was a tall, Corsican guy who was more interested in looting Egyptian artifacts for the sake of science than destroying them for kicks. I also put it out there that Napoleon had more in common with Steve Jobs than he did with Hitler. I stand by that comparison, but I might have been unfair to Napoleon when I said he was a jerk in private. You see, everything about Napoleon is controversial, and where one source describes him as a prickly bully, another describes him as warm, funny, and generally great to be around. One of my main sources for these episodes has been Andrew Roberts' exhaustive biography, Napoleon: A Life. Roberts' thesis in that book is basically, Napoleon was a great dude who would have been fun to kick it with. So, suffice it to say, everything about Napoleon, right down to his personality, is up for debate. But today we forge on. We're going to get to the height of Napoleon's power in Europe, his fall, his return, and his strange death. When we last left Napoleon, he had just secured for himself the position of First Consul of the French Republic. With a little help from his brother Lucien, he'd pulled off his coup within a coup and had become the new leader of France. But Napoleon was very concerned with how this transition to power was stage managed. He didn't want to look like some thug who had used his clout with the military to seize the reins of power. Bonaparte was a child of the revolution, so the whole thing needed to look like this was the will of the people. To that end, Napoleon put the question to a general vote, known as a plebiscite. When the new constitution that made him first consul was completed, he let the people vote on it. And wouldn't you know, they accepted Napoleon with a resounding 99.94%. Yes, that's 99.94% of people voting yes for the new constitution and yes for Napoleon. Now, this is crazy. 99.9% of people don't agree on anything, let alone politics. As a result, most historians believe this plebiscite was completely rigged. But believe it or not, there is still some debate on how rigged it was. Napoleon was incredibly popular, and many French people craved the stability that they believed he could bring. But 99.94? I mean, come on. But Napoleon was in power, and one of his first orders of business was to crush the so-called Second Coalition. This was the group of allied European states that had restarted the war against France while Napoleon was off in Egypt. They had managed to retake much of the Italian territory that Bonaparte had conquered. So, as you might imagine, Napoleon was eager to win that territory back. To do this, Napoleon devised a plan to surprise the Austrian troops in Italy. The plan was to audaciously cross the Alps with his army and hit his enemy from an unexpected direction. Now, Napoleon crossing the Alps is easily one of the most mythologized moments of his career. The most iconic image of Napoleon is painter Jacques-Louis David's depiction of this fabled crossing. This is the image of Napoleon mounted on the back of a rearing white steed, his cloak flowing behind him, his hand pointed forward as if to say, "Onward, glorious sons of France!" In the foreground, three names are etched into the living stone: Hannibal, Carlos Magnus, aka Charlemagne, and Bonaparte. Now, this painting helped enshrine this moment as the most daring and heroic achievement in Napoleon's career. The names in the foreground were put there purposefully to put Napoleon in the pantheon of great conquerors who had also dared to cross Europe's most formidable mountain range. But of course, David's painting, though iconic, has very little connection with the reality of that moment. Napoleon did not cross the Alps on an impressive warhorse. He rode a mule. A much more practical choice, but way less heroic. In fact, another painting depicting this more realistic version of events, Napoleon on a mule, that is, was created in 1850 after the artist saw David's in the Louvre. But no one other than art history students remembers that second painting. The first one is so ubiquitous that in Canada, the brand President's Choice once used it as a gimmick to sell Diet Cola. Just another example of a sexy myth taking the place of boring old facts. But however Napoleon crossed the Alps, he did it. And after a few close-fought battles with the Austrians that Napoleon very nearly lost, he was able to reassert French dominance in Italy. Before long, Napoleon would once again have the coalition powers retreating on all fronts. And soon, he would bring an end to the War of the Second Coalition, with France looking stronger than it had in decades. The Treaty of Lunéville was signed that took the Austrians out of the war, and in 1802, Bonaparte was even able to negotiate peace with France's most implacable enemy, Great Britain. For the first time since 1792, France was not at war with anyone. So Napoleon got to work fixing a country that had started a revolution over 10 years earlier because its affairs had been so poorly managed. 10 years on, many of those original problems were still, well, problems. If you're a Napoleon fan, his achievements in this period tend to be the things that get cited if you're trying to make the case that he was a historical good guy. He created the Napoleonic Code, a new logical code of laws for France that ensured that all citizens were equal before the law and were given the rights of due process. The code erased the ridiculous system of legal privilege that had existed in Ancien Régime France and stabilized the somewhat arbitrary system of justice used in the revolutionary years. The Napoleonic Code is still the basis of French law and the legal systems of dozens of other countries around the world, and many have argued that it is Napoleon's greatest achievement. Napoleon finally ended France's financial crisis. He created the Bank of France and started paying back France's enormous debts. France was a good investment for the first time in forever. Napoleon also managed to work out a new deal with the Catholic Church in the famous Concordat of 1801. You see, France's relationship with the Church had been pretty tumultuous for most of the Revolution. The Concordat essentially welcomed the Catholic Church back to France. However, Napoleon made it very clear that church and state were going to be separate, and freedom of worship was going to be a number one priority. Nonetheless, he was able to get Catholic conservatives, one of the most diehard anti-revolutionary groups in France, back on side with this historic proclamation. In these years, the quality of life in France really started to improve. Wages were going up, products that had not been on the market for years started reappearing in the shops, and many of the dreams of the early revolutionaries seemed to have been fulfilled. Even the émigrés, the French aristocrats who had fled France during the Revolution, slowly began to return. Many of them even reclaimed their old estates, but now they had to pay for them, just like everybody else. Hereditary privilege was gone, but the French were starting to live the high life again. Needless to say, Napoleon was extremely popular. But this is where Napoleon starts to take a turn. Up to this point, Napoleon had quite a lot of power, but he was still checked by a legislative assembly known as the Senate. His power was impressive, but it wasn't absolute. And Bonaparte seems to have wanted more. Capitalizing on his immense popularity, Napoleon had the Senate, now completely staffed with men loyal to him personally, draw up yet another new constitution for France. In this new constitution, Bonaparte was handed even more power and most importantly was declared to be first consul for life. Once again, Napoleon had the question put to a general vote in a plebiscite. And what do you know? 99.8% of the voters voted yes and wanted Napoleon as their consul for life. Now you'll notice that that result is exactly 0.1% less resounding than the last vote. One has to make these things look realistic, after all. Had now complete unchecked power over France, and if you believe the results of the plebiscites, the French were loving it. But despite that, Napoleon was still a favorite target for would-be assassins. I guess those guys didn't make it out to vote. But these assassination attempts would eventually provide Napoleon with the justification to complete his transformation of the French government. In 1804, the French police uncovered a plot to assassinate the first consul. The plot had been orchestrated by a group of royalists still loyal to the old Bourbon regime. Those were the Louis who had ruled France before the Revolution. But Napoleon took the opportunity to dispose of another old enemy. Potentially, and this is controversial, At the urging of his foreign minister Talleyrand, Napoleon had the Duke of Dungeon, the ruler of the neighboring principality of Baden, captured, secretly tried, and executed. Now, the Duke had nothing to do with the plot, and Napoleon knew that. The whole thing was just an expedient way to get revenge on an old enemy. It was a rare moment in Napoleon's career because it was kind of stupid. The execution of the Duke was scandalous to the rest of Europe and led to many states joining the British in a fresh coalition and going after France again. The incident is commemorated with a fake quote. Sometimes it gets attributed to Talleyrand, other times to Napoleon's chief of police. Nobody probably ever said this, but it brings home the point. It goes that the execution of the Duke was, quote, worse than a crime. It was a mistake, end quote. And of course, there's a great piece of fake history associated with this event. One conspiracy theory suggests that the Duke was actually killed because him and Bonaparte shared a mistress, and the Duke had caught Napoleon in a particular moment of weakness. This story was preserved in Tolstoy's epic War and Peace, where he writes, quote, "It was an anecdote, then current, to the effect that the Duc d'Angen had gone secretly to Paris to visit Mademoiselle Georges, that at her house he came upon Bonaparte, who also enjoyed the famous actress's favors, and that in his presence Napoleon happened to fall into one of his fainting fits to which he was subject, and thus was at the Duke's mercy. The latter spared him, and his magnanimity Bonaparte subsequently repaid by death." End quote. Now, we do know that Mademoiselle Georges was Napoleon's mistress at one point, but there is zero corroborating evidence to suggest that the Duke was also one of her lovers. But this little legend does reflect how confusing and scandalous this event was to most Europeans. The killing of the Duke seemed so malicious and out of character for Napoleon that many just assumed that some secret motive was at play. This little anecdote also plays around with another Napoleon myth, that the ruler had epilepsy. He did not. In fact, Napoleon might be one of the most wrongfully diagnosed people in history. Historians and writers from earlier eras have claimed that he had everything from syphilis to manic depression. But thanks to exhaustive records kept by Napoleon's physicians, we know that he was actually incredibly healthy. He even boasted about never getting sick. The only ailments we can safely say he had were hemorrhoids, and believe it or not, they're going to play a role later in the story, and eventually stomach cancer. But he was certainly not epileptic. Nonetheless, Napoleon had become convinced that his life would always be in danger as long as his title remained First Consul. So, to outmaneuver potential assassins and finalize his grip on power, Napoleon brought back hereditary monarchy. This is truly incredible given France's revolutionary history. This was the country, after all, who had publicly executed their king only a decade earlier, ostensibly for the crime of being a king. To justify this from a revolutionary perspective, Napoleon had to do some interesting logical backflips. In his mind, the only way to ensure the continuance of his government, which he saw as in keeping with the ideals of the revolution, he needed to make it so his death wouldn't mean the death of the regime. In a monarchy, in the event of his death, power would pass to his heirs, and all his work would not be undone. The revolution could continue. How's that for crazy? And so he had a new constitution created that named him Emperor, a title he chose to differentiate himself from the Ancien Régime kings of France, and put him in league with other, more ancient European leaders. He's credited with saying, and like many Napoleon quotes, he may have never said this, that, quote, he was not the heir of Louis XVI, but the heir of Charlemagne, end quote. On December 2nd, 1804, Napoleon crowned himself Emperor of the French in Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. Now, this is the basis for another great Napoleon myth. The story goes that at the coronation, the plan had been for the Pope to place the crown on Napoleon's head. But right at that crucial moment, Napoleon had shocked both the Pope and the assembled crowd by whirling around, grabbing the crown from the Pope's hands, and announcing, "No one crowns Napoleon but Napoleon," and then placing the crown on his own head. I love this story. All that's missing is for Napoleon to slap on a pair of shades and say, "Deal with it." But of course, this is a myth. But it's significant to note that Napoleon did crown himself at his coronation, which is still a rather audacious act. But this wasn't a surprise move that he pulled on the day of the coronation. Everything about the coronation had been pre-planned with the Pope, so there were zero surprises on that day. Here's how it actually went. Napoleon entered the room wearing a crown of gold laurel leaves. At the right time, the Pope passed the crown to Napoleon, who then held it over his head. He didn't put it on his head, because he was already wearing a crown. And then Napoleon passed the crown back to the Pope. And that's exactly how it went. The message was clear. Although the Pope was invited, the Pope had no power over Napoleon. No one did. Napoleon crowns himself. It was such a racy move, even in that staged managed version that's closer to reality, that painters actually shied away from painting that moment. Napoleon's favorite painter, Jacques-Louis David, actually chose to depict the moment when Napoleon crowned his wife, Josephine. It was such a ballsy and unprecedented move to crown yourself that David thought it was a bit much to paint. Napoleon putting his own crown on his own head was a bold turning point in European history, and kind of a gangster move. All the best Napoleon myths have to do with his rise and fall. So we need to make a big jump to the end of Napoleon's career to get to more of the great legends. But it seems wrong to say nothing about that hot 10-year period between 1804 and 1814. So I'm going to do my best to cram 10 years of crazy history into two paragraphs. Wish me luck. Okay. This is when Napoleon really changed the world. In these years, Napoleon was basically unbeatable on the battlefield. Coalitions of European powers continued to rise against him, and he continued to destroy them. He built his famous Grande Armée, which had been created for a potential invasion of Britain. But after the loss at the Battle of Trafalgar, that seemed impossible. So he turned it on the rest of Europe. He conquered Spain, Germany, and the Austrian Empire, which at the time made up most of Central Europe. He seized Vienna, and not long after that, he seized Berlin. He redrew the map of Europe, erasing old countries and creating new ones, all the while putting his brothers and sisters on the thrones of these new vassal states. He also basically rewrote the book on warfare. To beat him, his contemporaries would have to become him. His greatest rival in the field, the Duke of Wellington, was essentially a student of Napoleon's tactics. At its height, the French Empire stretched from the Atlantic all the way to the borders of Russia. And in Russia is where it would all come crashing down. Napoleon's ill-fated invasion of Russia started a turn of fortunes that would eventually lead to the collapse of the French Empire and the end of Napoleon's time as emperor. He led the largest land army in history into Russia, a force that's been estimated to be between 400,000 and 600,000 men strong. But what do you know? The sources disagree on that one, too.
What is certain is that after enduring scorched earth tactics by the Russians, they actually burnt down Moscow just so Napoleon couldn't bunker down there, and the notoriously horrific Russian winter, or as Russians sometimes call that season, General Winter, Napoleon limped out of Russia with only 1/10 of his troops. Hundreds of thousands died, and Napoleon's armies would never really be the same again. Over the next 2 years, the newly emboldened coalition was able to push Napoleon all the way back to France. In 1814, the leaders in Paris surrendered to the coalition forces who occupied the city. Napoleon was turned over to them, and the Bourbons, the old Louis, were back in charge of France. Oh, can you believe it, guys? We made it. Now we're back in mythological territory. To smooth the transition from the Bonapartist regime to the newly restored monarchy, they had to make it look like Napoleon was stepping down willingly. So instead of executing him or throwing him in a cell, they actually cut him a pretty nice deal. If he abdicated without any fuss, he would get to be the King of Elba, a tiny island quite close to his native Corsica. Now, of course, he was not allowed to leave this island, but he was allowed to live in style, make laws for the island, and host all kinds of visitors. He was in exile, but rarely do you get to be the king of your own penal colony. I love the stories of Napoleon on Elba, because he really throws himself into the job of being the king of this little island. He was writing new laws, starting infrastructure projects, creating state welfare for the poor, designing uniforms for his household servants. He was easily the best king Elba ever had. But this is also the setting for some of the final Napoleon myths. First is the story that while on the island, Napoleon came up with this wistful palindrome: "Able was I ere I saw Elba." Now, for those of you who don't know, a palindrome is a sentence, word, or phrase that is the same when written both backwards and forwards. Kayak is another example. But this one is rather impressive. It's a whole sentence. Write it out and you'll see. Able was I ere I saw Elba. You can write it forwards or backwards and it's exactly the same. This is often credited to Bonaparte. Some sources saying he said it to his coalition-appointed watchdog, and others saying that he said it to a visiting reporter. The truth is that he didn't say it at all. Napoleon didn't even speak English at this point in his life, aside from a few basic phrases, so it's highly improbable that he was whipping out witty palindromes. We know that Napoleon only started to learn English later in life when he was imprisoned on yet another faraway island. There is also reason to believe that this palindrome was invented by someone named JTR of Baltimore, who likes sending palindromes into an American periodical. But my source on that one is a little shady, so handle that with care. Either way, Napoleon definitely did not say, "Able was I ere I saw Elba." But now we have finally arrived at my favorite chapter of Napoleon's life, his surprising escape from Elba. After 10 months of living in exile, word started to trickle back to Napoleon that there was some serious discontent with the old Bourbon monarchy. Louis XVIII was basically carrying on as if the French Revolution had never happened, and Napoleon had been some sort of a bad dream. Not only did this alienate the average French citizen, but it particularly rankled the army. Louis was ignoring their old military honors and even started renaming some of their divisions, changing the Napoleonic numeric system back to more fanciful royalist names. Imagine if you had fought in the 5th. And you'd won glory in the 5th, and all your best friends were from the 5th, and now you were forced to call yourself something like Le Compagnie d'Orléans. That might grind your gears. You were the 5th! Knowing that tensions were running high, Napoleon acted. While his British overseer was away on business in Italy, Napoleon hopped a ship and set sail for the French coast. he landed with a modest entourage in Golfe Jaune, France, and immediately sent letters out to be read all over the country, proclaiming that he had returned to rid the country of the tyrant Louis XVIII. He then started to march toward Paris, purposefully taking a more roundabout route in order to avoid the parts of France he knew to be royalist hotbeds. As he marched, he was joined by more and more supporters, excited that he had returned. And then, on March 7th, just south of Grenoble, the greatest thing ever happened. Louis XVIII sent a regiment of the army, the 5th to be exact, to stop Napoleon in his tracks. The story goes that when the army encountered Napoleon and his followers, they trained their guns on them and were ready to fire. But at that crucial moment, Napoleon ran out in front of the troops. He tore open his coat and screamed, "If you want to shoot your emperor, here I am!" The troops waited. A silence settled on the road. And then the clear sound of weeping could be heard. The troops sent by Louis XVIII were actually crying. And then one soldier yelled out, "Vive l'Empereur! Long live the Emperor!" And soon, all of them were chanting it. They lowered their guns, and instead of shooting Napoleon, they joined him. With a full army regiment now under his control, Napoleon continued on to Paris. Louis XVIII fled in a stagecoach, and just like that, Napoleon was once again Emperor of the French. I love that story. It's just such a boss move. In fact, I like that story so much, that is the inspiration for this entire episode. So, when I started researching, I had to know, did that event actually happen? It seemed like such a good story that, oh my God, it had to be fake. But I'm happy to report that this actually did happen. Kinda. There are two other accounts of how this event went down. One of them comes from one of Napoleon's compatriots who was there that day. He says that instead of dramatically tearing open his coat and screaming, Napoleon instead walked towards his troops cool as a cucumber, and then proceeded to carry out an inspection as though he was still their general. He walked up and down the line, asking the men how they were being treated, if their rations were good, asking about their equipment, and then capping the whole thing by asking them, "You guys want to join me?" At which point they all yelled, "Vive l'Empereur!" Now there's another version as well. According to Andrew Roberts, when Napoleon himself told the story, he played it like he was even more chummy with the men with the guns. Napoleon's version of the story is that he went right up to one of these enemy infantry men, clapped the man on the back like he was an old buddy, and said, "You old rascal, you're not actually going to shoot me, are you?" At which point, they all started cheering. Personally, I don't really know which story is better. All of them are great, and they all reinforce the same basic details. Napoleon stole a regiment that was sent to kill him from King Louis. So, Napoleon, hate him or love him, I think we can all agree that that move was supremely badass. Napoleon's reclamation of France is one of the most improbable second acts in history. Unfortunately for Bonaparte, it would be short-lived. Napoleon's second attempt at being emperor lasted just over 3 months, or the proverbial 100 days. Napoleon met his ultimate defeat at the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. Now, the outcome of this battle has fascinated military historians and war gamers ever since, because Napoleon really should have won. In fact, when people wargame the Battle of Waterloo, the French usually come out ahead. The cause of the French defeat is a matter of some serious historical debate. But one thing that is clear is that Napoleon himself was sluggish and sleepy on the day of the battle. Many people believe that if Napoleon had ordered his forces to attack the British under the command of the Duke of Wellington at first light on the morning of the battle, they could have won. Instead, Napoleon sleeps in. It's not until 10 a.m. that he's ordering the first troop movements. This bought Wellington the time he needed to arrange for a more strenuous defense, and it meant that the Prussians had more time to get to the battle. Wellington himself has said that if the Prussians didn't arrive when they did, it would have been curtains for the British. Had Napoleon attacked earlier, he could have beat the British before those Prussians ever had a chance to arrive. There are a million what-ifs when it comes to Waterloo, and the speculation game can get messy. But most of the theories about Waterloo have to do with Napoleon's personal health. Some have speculated that Napoleon was groggy on the morning of Waterloo because he was dealing with an opium hangover. He may have been using opium to treat the pain which may have been associated with stomach cancer. However, there isn't much evidence of this. Napoleon biographer Andrew Roberts, who I've quoted earlier in this episode, doesn't even present opium as an option. However, Roberts does include another culprit for Napoleon's sluggishness: hemorrhoids. I told you they'd come back. We know from earlier letters to his brother Joseph that Napoleon at one point suffered from hemorrhoids, but he claimed in those letters that he had cured himself by putting leeches on his butt. And I'm not making that up. Well, perhaps at Waterloo the hemorrhoids had returned. Roberts points to the fact that Napoleon spent very little time on his horse, and when he was being helped to mount his horse, he screamed out in pain and then reprimanded his groom, saying that when you help someone to mount their horse, it is best done gently. Apparently, Napoleon was also constantly requesting to be alone at the time of the battle, perhaps to deal with hemorrhoid pain. Again, this is all speculation, but I kind of love thinking that hemorrhoids decided one of the most important battles in European history. After Napoleon was defeated for the last time, he was again sent into exile, but this time he was not going to be the king of Elba, a breezy one day's sail from France. His new island prison was the British holding of St. Helena, which was located in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, roughly between Brazil and the coast of Africa. He would live there in relative comfort. He was allowed to bring servants and a few buddies along with him for the next 6 years. He would eventually die on the island in 1821. But because this is Napoleon, even his death has a conspiracy theory tacked onto it. So here we go with the final Napoleon myth. So the typical cause of death given for Napoleon is stomach cancer. After he died, an autopsy was performed by his personal physician on St. Helena. In the autopsy, a large tumor was found in his stomach, as well as a nasty ulcer that had apparently burnt through the walls of his stomach lining. But here's where things get fishy. Parts of the autopsy report were scrubbed out by the British. And, for some reason, the main physician didn't sign the final report. Now, conspiracy theorists have seen this as evidence that Napoleon was actually poisoned. By who, do you ask? Well, Napoleon had no shortage of enemies. The obvious contenders are either his British captors or Bourbon assassins afraid of yet another coming of Napoleon. The theory goes that the assassins were slipping small amounts of arsenic into his food, which eventually rotted his stomach and poisoned him to death. When Napoleon's body was disinterred and moved in the 1840s, it was noticed that he was in great shape. The body had not really decayed. And as we all know, arsenic is an amazing preservative. So it was possible that this had been a type of arsenic mummification. This theory was given even more credence when, in 1960, a lock of Napoleon's hair was tested for arsenic, And sure enough, the hare came back positive for high levels of the poison. This led a number of historians and investigators to write books about a possible assassination, the most famous being Who Killed Napoleon by Sten Forsfund. So for a while, the common consensus became that Napoleon had been murdered on St. Helena, but a 2007 study has basically put all of that to rest. A group of modern doctors pored over Napoleon's medical records and then matched them with what we know about modern medicine. We actually have extremely detailed records of Napoleon's medical condition when he was on St. Helena, and everything described by them leading up to his death and during the autopsy is consistent with the diagnosis of stomach cancer. On top of that, Napoleon's father died of stomach cancer, and so did one of his sisters. Stomach cancer seems to have been a family issue. So, how do we explain the arsenic? Well, that's not as hard as we might think. There are a few explanations. First of all, Napoleon's wallpaper in his house at St. Helena was green. Now, that might not seem all that remarkable, but green paint used to have extremely high levels of arsenic. There are even cases from history where green paint actually killed people. Recently, a sample of Napoleon's wallpaper was tested, and sure enough, it was full of arsenic. Culprit number two is the hair tonic used by Napoleon, which also, when tested, was apparently chock full of arsenic. Another theory is that Napoleon had been purposefully dosing himself with arsenic for years. Back in the early 1800s, it was common for people to use arsenic as a recreational drug and also as a painkiller. So maybe back at Waterloo, Napoleon was sluggish because he got deep into the arsenic the night before. But even if Napoleon wasn't purposefully dosing himself, the truth of the matter is that people were exposed to way more arsenic in Napoleon's time than they are in our own. The analysis of Napoleon's hair found arsenic at 10 parts per million, whereas his contemporary, George III of England, who no one thinks was poisoned, was found to have arsenic at 13 parts per million in his hair. There is also a third possibility that the conspiracy theorists never seem to want to bring up, that he was both being poisoned and he had stomach cancer, which was entirely possible. But personally, I'm convinced that his death came as a result of the disease. The British really wanted to keep Napoleon healthy and seemed desperate to make it look like he had not contracted any diseases while he'd been on St. Helena. In fact, many historians think that the doctoring of the autopsy report was to cover up other ailments that Napoleon might have had, like hepatitis B, that he would have contracted from living on the island. So the British did not want him dead, ironically, because it made them look like bad jailers. So I think we can safely say that it was cancer that took the life of one of the age's most unbelievable people. So, how do you sum up a character like Napoleon? He's not an easy person to summarize. Everything about him resists it. But I think the number and diverse variety of legends associated with Napoleon are a testament to the complexity of his character. Over these two episodes, we have explored stories that have cast Napoleon as everything from a short-statured egomaniac, a wise-cracking bon vivant, a murderously jealous lover, a destroyer of ancient monuments, and a clever creator of palindromes. And none of these various personas truly captured the real Napoleon. Even from his earliest days, Napoleon always was more of a myth than a man. Sometimes this myth served him, like when an enemy general would retreat from the field just because they heard that Napoleon was there commanding the other army. And sometimes his myth has haunted him, like the persistent belief that he basically invented the inferiority complex. One thing that is for sure is that Napoleon never felt inferior to anyone. He truly believed he could do anything. And that's kind of inspiring. Even when the things he is credited with doing seem impossible, we should remember what Napoleon said about the word impossible. He said, quote, "The word impossible is only found in the dictionary of fools." Except, he probably never said that. Okay, that's all for this week. Thank you again for joining me. If you want to get in touch with me, you can send me an email at rfakehistory@gmail.com, or you can reach out on Twitter at rfakehistory, or you can go to our Facebook page where you can like us and follow along at Facebook/rfakehistory. I want to say thank you to everyone that's reached out and sent messages on Twitter and Facebook and via the email. It's been really nice. It's been nice to hear from you guys. So everyone else out there, I'd love to hear from you. So don't be shy. I also wanted to take a minute to talk about the Donate to the Podcast button on the website. So if you go to the website at rfakehistory.com and you look on the right side of the page, you'll see a little link that says Donate to the Podcast. Think of that as basically like a tip jar for the podcast. So just like if you went to a bar and you saw a band and you thought the band was okay and they were passing the hat after the show and you think, "Ow, what the heck, I'll throw in a couple dollars." That's basically what I'm asking you to do here. If you like the show, you think it's worth a couple bucks, then click on the Donate to the Podcast link and send that money our way. We would really appreciate it. It will help the podcast continue to operate. You can also go to iTunes where you can rate and review the show. A positive review goes a long way, so thanks to everyone that's already done that. Thanks again for being patient with my gravelly voice. I've been really trying to stick to this 2-week release schedule, and I did not want our second part of the Napoleon series to be late. I believe that's all for this week. Thanks again for listening, guys. This has been such an awesome experience, and I got more for you. There's more coming, so stick with me. All right. All the theme music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. Check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. All the other music you've heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.
One gift that never gets returned? Trick question. It's 3 gifts: beer, wine, and spirits. And with Drizly, you can send the gift of drinks right to your loved one's doors. Drizly lets you compare prices from local liquor stores on a huge selection of beer, wine, and holiday spirits, then get them delivered right to that lucky someone's door in under 60 minutes. And right now, Drizly is giving customers $5 off their first order. Just enter promo code JINGLE at checkout. Download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's drizly.com.